From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, the VW emissions scandal, big and getting bigger.
They wanted to essentially avoid American regulation. And so now they've got the full weight of regulation coming down on their proverbial neck.
The history of Latinos in West Michigan.
It really began to take off in the 1930s. You know, farmers in West Michigan had been using migrant and seasonal workers for some decades.
The barbershop chats. Give a kid a free haircut. Talk about his future.
All of you have gifts, and we want you to start working those gifts, but you got to start working them now. All right.
And the Hell's Half Mile Film and Music Festival. We'll get a preview of what's happening this weekend in Bay City. Those stories and more today on Stateside. It's a long, long road from someone's great idea all the way to a company that's on its feet. One of the biggest pitfalls.
Most sources of money to help grow a business don't want to come to the business until after that big technology risk is solved. So we call it the comeback when problem.
I'm Cynthia Canty. Coming up on The Next Idea, our latest contributors tell us about a big helping hand that Uncle Sam can give to entrepreneurs here in Michigan. But first, Volkswagen cheated and lied to its customers. The German automaker admitted to cheating on the U.S. emissions test of 500,000 of its diesel vehicles. A big head has already rolled over this scandal, and Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes said this is not even the end of the beginning. Daniel, you were based in Germany for 4 years, so you have some deep perspective here. Explain to us exactly what they did.
Well, what they did was they developed a computer program that controls the anti-pollution emission systems on diesel engines, and they programmed it to sense when it was in a testing environment. So the steering wheel wouldn't move, for example, and other things that would enable the computer to sense that it was in a testing environment. And then when it was, the program would turn on all of the emissions systems so that when they were tested, they passed. But when they were in normal driving conditions, when the steering wheel's moving and other things are moving in the car, the system would turn off. And therefore, people would get a little better fuel economy. They would get a little better torque performance out of the engine, a little more push, that kind of feeling in the lower back you get when you step on the accelerator, which diesels are very good at. They deliver a lot of torque. So that's essentially what they did.
And how did this get blown? I guess because it's been going on for a while.
Well, it's kind of a tortured story, but basically there were some academics down in West Virginia who started doing some research and testing some Volkswagen vehicles and a BMW vehicle to see if they were in compliance, and they started to look at the data, and it didn't look right to them. And eventually this gets back to the EPA and the California Air Resources Board, who are the two most powerful regulators, certainly in the United States. And they started asking questions and started pushing the Germans at Volkswagen and asking them questions. And they kept denying it. And then as recently as, I think, August last month, finally an official from Volkswagen acknowledged that, in fact, they had put in what's called a defeat switch or defeat mechanism that was on these cars. And it affected 482,000 vehicles in the United States. And they later confirmed early this week that it's 11 million vehicles worldwide are equipped with that technology.
I got to wonder. So here we have VW touting the fact that its diesel vehicles are cleaner than the competition. So I'm the CEO of Canty Motors. I'm going to have my engineers get that VW, tear it down, and figure out how to get our vehicles to that level. Because we all know benchmarking happens. And
sure.
You got to wonder, how did this not get discovered by the competition?
Well, it might have been. I mean, I think that's one of the questions that people are going to be asking, particularly in Europe. Now, it's important for listeners to understand something, that diesel engines only account for about 1% of the engines in the American passenger fleet. They're about 50% of the fleet in Europe, and depending on the country and the segment you're in, they can be plus or minus more or less than that. So I think this is a much bigger issue potentially in Europe than it is in the United States, just in terms of penetration into the marketplace. Now, the diesel regulations in Europe are more lax than they are in the United States. This is the toughest market in the world for diesel cars. The environmental lobby is very opposed to it. There have been some instances where diesels have not acquitted themselves well back in the 80s when General Motors had put diesels into their Oldsmobiles and it was a belching mess.
I remember that.
But that's a generation and a half removed. But nevertheless, diesel has not been very popular in the United States. And the third thing is that diesel fuel in Europe is a lot less expensive, and in many cases, depending on the price of gasoline, is less expensive than gasoline per liter. So that explains part of the penetration. Here, it typically is more than gasoline. Gasoline has to get very expensive for diesel to be less. So it's just a totally different animal. But all that said, I think the American regulators and the American lawyers are going to make this very expensive for Volkswagen, because they're going to charge that people were buying a product that they believed was clean diesel, and in fact they were equipped with this computer program that were switching off, and it was a dirty diesel.
Well, okay, apart from the public humiliation, we've seen CEO Martin Winterkorn stepping down, and we hear more firings will be expected by week's end. What else do you foresee happening at VW?
This is very embarrassing, not only for the company, but for the country. It's important for people to understand that Volkswagen is a cornerstone of industrial Germany, what they call Deutschland AG, which is this kind of mythical conjuring of great German companies with global reach. And I would add, you know, Daimler would be another one, Deutsche Bank would be another one, Siemens would be another one. They're the pillars of German industry. And implicit in that is we do things right, we follow the rules, we expect other people to do that. The German government clearly has been lecturing the people in Southern Europe in the financial mess that they've been dealing with, particularly in Greece, about that. And now this blows up in their face. And so you have an iconic company that is very closely associated with Deutschland AG that has proven that it doesn't follow the rules. And in fact, it is very duplicitous.
And as you say in your columns this week, the lawyers are just tuning up, aren't they?
Any question about it. You know, one of the things that I remember from my days in Germany when I was covering Daimler Chrysler, one of the things that struck real fear in the heart of German executives was the American litigation, because they knew it was unpredictable, it could be very expensive, and it could be very damaging to the company, to its brands, to its reputation. And so here you have a situation with Volkswagen where they wanted to essentially avoid American regulation. And so now they've got the full weight of regulation coming down on their proverbial neck and the American plaintiff's bar.
We're speaking with Detroit News business columnist Daniel House about the VW emissions scandal. And as you pointed out in your column earlier this week, Daniel, we've seen Toyota and then General Motors and now Volkswagen get hauled to the proverbial woodshed, or will be, to learn a lesson that the cover-up often is worse than the crime.
Well, I think that's right. And in each of these cases, that's what has happened. I think the problem for Volkswagen is twofold. One is it's third. It's not first. So you could argue, have they learned the lessons of these other companies? And I think the answer is probably not. Although them finally coming clean in the last month may have been somewhat influenced by what they saw General Motors doing, thinking that if we come clean, maybe it won't be so bad or as bad as it otherwise would be. So, and the second thing, I think, is that this walks right into the very divisive area of environmental politics. This is about clean air. It's about regulation. And we kind of live in an environment in this country right now where people are very sensitive about that kind of thing. I've already had people saying to me, well, look, 124 people were certified as having died in the General Motors situation, and none have died here. Yet we're talking about fines that are going to be potentially much, much higher than what General Motors ultimately agreed to pay. I think we don't know what those numbers are going to be like, and we shouldn't prejudge them. But there's no question but what this is also trips the wire of environmental politics.
And I'm wondering, and you touched on this in your column, is this something that is driving perhaps Capitol Hill towards a move to criminalize corporate misbehavior?
I think it's possible. You know, one of the things we heard when the General Motors settlement was announced last week was the U.S. attorney in the Southern District of New York said, look, I just want people to understand here that there are no laws on the books that allow us to charge a corporation with a crime. We can charge individuals with crimes, and that, in fact, may still happen in the General Motors case because people apparently are still under investigation. But there are no laws on the books. I think if you get more and more of these kinds of cases, I wonder if somebody, I'm not saying it's going to become law, but I wouldn't be surprised at all to see somebody drop some bills that try to somehow create some kind of regime where they can actually go after a corporation and charge it with some kind of crime. Whether or not that gets any legs or not, I think remains to be seen.
We've seen Toyota, we've seen General Motors, now we've got VW. What does this all tell us about the global auto industry?
Well, there's a long history in the auto industry of trying to skirt or game regulations for reasons generally of cost and or performance that can please the customer. And I suspect that you're not going to see, this isn't going to be the end to those kind of practices. That said, I do think that companies have already, in the General Motors case is probably the best example, have already kind of changed their regulatory, their internal regulatory systems and safety systems to say, look, we cannot have these kinds of people or these situations where people are freelancing and trying to fix something on their own because they think that's what's good for the company. And we certainly can't do it if it goes all the way up to the top of the house. Because the costs are too great. Now, there are people who would argue that, you know what, sometimes that's the cost of doing business. You figure it's going to cost me X hundreds of millions of dollars if we get caught, but if we don't get caught, we're going to make a heck of a lot more money. Well, yes and no, and I'm sure there are people that run companies that way, but I think in large part they want to avoid those kind of problems. Because in the world we live in where it's a 24/7 news cycle, social media, I think the damage can be much more severe, much faster than it used to be.
Detroit News business columnist Daniel House. Thanks so much, Daniel.
Thank you.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The history of West Michigan's Hispanic community is deeply rooted in agriculture. Migrant, immigrant, and seasonal workers have been the backbone of the agriculture industry there for decades, harvesting crops from sugar beets to peaches, cherries, and apples. Now it's estimated in the next 10 or 15 years, West Michigan may well have the largest concentration of Latinos in the state. Let's learn more about the history and future for Latinos in West Michigan. Ruben Martinez is with us again. Ruben is the director of the Julian Zamora Research Institute at Michigan State University.
Thank you. Good to be on.
We know West Michigan has a sizable Hispanic migrant community because of the agriculture industry. When did this population really begin to take off?
It really began to take off in the 1930s. You know, farmers in West Michigan had been using migrant and seasonal workers for some decades before that, but Latinos did not come in any sizable numbers till about the 1930s and then began to settle out. That means settling out of the migrant stream, probably in good numbers in the 40s.
And were we seeing whole families coming, Ruben?
Yes, Michigan was historically a family-friendly state, meaning that it was set up, the farmers were set up to host families, and that has continued, I think, basically up until a couple of decades ago.
And where did this first influx of migrants come from when they started arriving in force in the 1930s?
I think we had a combination of Mexican Americans from South Texas and Mexican immigrants from Mexico. We had just finished the Mexican Civil War, which, as we all know very well today, displaces people. So we had a good number of refugees from Mexico during the Mexican Revolution coming into South Texas. And then we also had native-born South Texans coming up here. And the sending area, at least for the native-born, one should know, is that South Texas has historically been a very, very poor region for a long time.
And then we see more workers coming from Florida. We also see a rise of single men coming to work in the fields in the 1990s. And I also want you to talk about the H-2A visa for temporary agricultural workers. What effect has that had on this population and West Michigan as a whole?
Well, you know, we started a guest worker program with Mexico during World War II because of the labor shortages. And that ended in 1964. But we also maintained guest worker programs over time that just hadn't been given the kind of attention that they're getting today. But for Michigan, H-2A workers had not been very prevalent. I mean, the program wasn't used very much because there was a steady stream of workers who had intergenerational ties to the region and coming up here. But I think with the anti-immigrant fervor that has taken hold over the last decade, made it difficult for some of them to travel and so forth. So that led to some labor shortages and I think causing some of the employers, the agricultural employers, to see if they could find other means by which they could meet their labor demands.
I'm wondering, kind of looking and taking us up to where we are today, how has that migrant community changed over time in West Michigan? So here we are at 2015. How have we seen it progress?
some shifts have taken place. One, it is considerably smaller than it used to be. I believe back in the 1950s, we used to have as many as 300,000 migrant workers coming to Michigan. I mean, you had the beet crop, the sugar beets, as a major crop here in the state that has declined. There's been mechanization over the years, which has reduced the need for workers. And so now, basically, we get them in the fruits and vegetable areas, asparagus, blueberries, peaches, apples, and so forth. And, you know, there's even some efforts to try to mechanize the harvest of apples and so on. So that's been one of the things that changed. I mentioned already the shift to include more people coming up from Florida, and the shift from families to more single males, and also to increasingly now in more recent years to H-2A workers.
I think a lot of people are going to be surprised to learn that there is such a sizable Latino community in West Michigan. I know when I saw the statistic from Holland that 23% of Holland's population is Hispanic.
Well, you know, the great growth occurred across the country in terms of the Latino population between 1990 and 2000, between those two census years. And typically, I think the average growth across the country was about 57%. We saw similar rates of growth here in the population there in Grand Rapids and so on. But the highest concentration in West Michigan really is in the Grand Rapids area. And if you take the metro area, you find, you know, approximately 90,000 Latinos living in the Grand Rapids metro area. And I would venture to say that in the next decade, it could conceivably become the largest concentration of Latinos in the state.
Ruben Martinez is the director of the Julian Zamora Research Institute at Michigan State University. Thank you so much for talking with us. Always great to have you on Stateside, Ruben.
Thank you very much.
When most of us think of Holland, the West Michigan community's Dutch heritage comes to mind. But as you just heard, there is a sizable Hispanic community in Holland. And to mark Hispanic Heritage Month, the city's collecting the oral histories of Holland's Hispanic Americans. Esther Fifelski is with us now. She's the Human International Relations Manager for the City of Holland. Welcome, Esther.
Thank you, Cynthia. Pleasure to be speaking with you.
And Sister Noella Poinsett is with the Outreach and Social Justice Program at St. Francis de Sales Catholic Church in Holland. Sister Noella, good to have you with us today.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Esther, what do you say to the rest of Michigan who learn that nearly a quarter of your city's population is Hispanic and say, wait, what? We had no idea.
I would just like to say that it is a hidden history. A lot of people don't know that there's a large Hispanic community. And the Hispanic community is due a lot to the migrant work that we used to have here in previous years. And a lot of those migrant workers have stayed and made a life here in Holland.
And this oral history project is called Nuestra Comunidad Hispania, Our Hispanic Community. Tell us exactly what's happening.
Well, what we're doing is we're reaching out to the community to invite members of the Hispanic community to share their stories as part of National Hispanic Heritage Month. And we're hoping to put together, gather the stories, put together a profile, and then celebrate them at our LAHUP dinner in November.
And LAHUP stands for Latin Americans United for Progress, a group you're working with. And Sister Noella, there are a lot of groups taking part in this project, and one of them being your parish, St. Francis de Sales. Tell us a little more about the people that you meet through your work in outreach and social justice.
Well, the parish is 55% to 60% Hispanic, and social justice has always been my passion in working with diverse populations. So just great to be part of this Nuestra Comunidad Hispana.
Esther, what do you feel are some of the biggest challenges the community faces in Holland?
Education continues to be one of those focal points where we need to continue to develop our young students. The economy and jobs. With limited incomes, then you have the problem of affordable housing, living wages. And I think health care is also an issue for the Hispanic community. And at the very core of it is, how can we change things? And I would just have to say that voter participation is another thing, another area where we need to work on drawing more people of color to our city hall, to our local governments. I think that really would help the situation in any cultural community.
Sister, what kinds of stories do you expect the project will collect?
Well, I think, like with the first seven people that we did the stories, we got them through St. Francis de Sales Parish. And one of the good things with with that group is that we've got diversity in class and countries where they're from. So from Mexico, of course, and from Nicaragua, Colombia, I think somebody was represented. So in this way, we'll have a variety of stories, some veterans, some who've been migrant workers or the parents have been migrant workers, and the struggle and the sacrifice that the parents made in bringing their families here as migrants, but believing in education, and so making that possible for their children and grandchildren.
Esther Fafelski is the Human International Relations Manager for the City of Holland, and Sister Noella Poinsett is with Outreach and Social Justice at St. Francis de Sales Catholic Church in Holland. And you can find out more about Nuestra Comunidad Hispana at the City of Holland website is a good place to start as they collect those oral histories through National Hispanic Heritage Month. Very good to talk with both of you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
The 2002 movie Barbershop, starring Ice Cube and Cedric the Entertainer, gave us a comedic glimpse of a day in the life of a barbershop on Chicago's South Side.
In my day, a barber was a counselor, a fashion expert, style coach, pimp, just general all-around hustler. But the problem with y'all cats today is that you got no skill, no sense of history. And then... With a straight face, got the nerve to want to be somebody. Want somebody to respect you. But it take respect to get respect. Understand?
Oh, the barbershop, a place to talk about life, politics, neighborhood gossip. Now there's a group in Detroit using that very forum to get kids to engage and think about college. It's called Barbershop Chats. And it's gaining recognition for the way that it engages young African-American men. Stateside's Mercedes Mejia takes us into one of these chats in Detroit.
I'm 15, I'm in the 10th grade.
I'm in a building in Detroit's new center where youth outreach programs take place. In this room, clippers are buzzing, and a few high school guys sit and wait for their turn in the barber's chair. And Edmund Lewis Jr. is giving them a back-to-school pep talk.
This school stuff, this stuff is important, but you have to get in there and figure out your mission and figure out your personal vision and also what the man above has for you to do.
Lewis began the barbershop chats just a few years ago. He's the founder and CEO of Minority Males for Higher Education. That's a Detroit-based nonprofit that gives young black boys and men resources and support they need to get to college.
Many of them lack mentors. Many of them lack father figures at home. And I wanted to bring something together that supports them overall and give them an opportunity to hang out and have fun.
The goal of the barbershop chats is to engage these young kids in conversations about college and about challenges they might be facing at home or in school. Lewis brings in working professionals from the community to talk to the kids. At this chat, there's a lawyer, a social worker, and a pro basketball player. They're all talking about the role of fathers. Shane Lawal is the pro basketball player. He opens up about his childhood.
One of the main reasons why I am how I am is because I don't want to be like my father. It's a big drive for why I do the things the way I do, because I can see that the way he approached life was very unsuccessful.
Lawal's story is pretty familiar to 18-year-old Curtis Cox, who says he doesn't have a positive male role model at home. But he does have a big brother, a mentor, who brought him here to this barbershop chat for the first time.
It's nice. Let's say y'all got people in here that care about the youths, you know, see what they want to do with their life, ask a lot of questions. I haven't been to, like, a lot of places that asked it.
But this senior in high school says he's not sure what he wants to do when he graduates.
I just want to be successful. You know? I don't want to fail my family.
And the odds aren't great for young men like Cox. According to the latest census, only 13% of Detroiters aged 25 and older have a bachelor's degree or higher. That's half the state average. But programs like the Barbershop Chats hope to bridge that gap. Jalen Barney is a high school senior. He says things were touch and go for him only a few years ago.
I was 12, got suspended every other day. Kept getting in trouble, constant trouble. He came in, I moved in with him. I switched schools, and everything has been just peachy ever since then, just good.
Barney moved in with his uncle, that lawyer I mentioned earlier. And that uncle is the positive male role model in Barney's life. Now he's on a better path and has plans to go to college. I asked him what he gets out of the conversations.
Knowledge about life. actually having talks with men of my community about life, problems that we are facing as individuals, well, men, of course, and yeah, it's good information.
Information is exactly what Edmund Lewis wants to give these young men. Things like how to apply to college and how to choose the right college. But also, Lewis just wants to support them and be a positive role model in their lives. He says he does it because he didn't have a strong male figure encouraging him to go to college when he was a young man. The barbershop chats are one way Lewis is giving back. And he hopes these young men achieve success in life, whatever they choose to do after high school.
Some of them don't want to go to college. Okay, I understand it. So what are you going to do if you're not going to college? What else is there to do? What's your plan? 4-year university may not be for you. What about community college? What are the options? So you give them every opportunity and every resource for they to do everything but say no.
Since the barbershop chats began 4 years ago, Lewis has seen progress. One young man got his associate's degree from Oakland Community College and is now teaching English in Korea. Another has started a 4-year degree at Alabama State University. Another is interning at Tesla Automotive in San Francisco. For Stateside, I'm Mercedes Mejia.
On a recent visit to a fancy restaurant, our Detroit's chief restaurant critic and wine writer Chris Cook noticed a lot of fuss happening at another table. With great ceremony, a sommelier was decanting the wine, ceremoniously pouring the entire bottle into a glass carafe on the side table. And Chris thought, well, what's the matter with my wine? Chopped liver? He's been thinking about the practice of decanting wines, when to do it, and it seems to be something of a mystery.
At a posh restaurant in Birmingham recently, I asked our server how the decision to decant a wine is made. The answer was a bit of a shock. It depends on the price of the wine, he said. If you bought a red wine that's more than $100 a bottle, the wine will be decanted at your table, and as a bonus, they will bring the bigger, more expensive wine glasses. When I asked what happens if I bought a $40 a bottle of wine, I was told that it would not, quote, qualify, unquote, to be decanted, and I would get regular wine glasses. This, in all frankness, is one of the most pretentious things I've ever heard. The purpose of decanting wine has never had anything to do with the price, but rather with the suspected condition of the wine. If the wine is older, it is more likely to have thrown off a lot of sediment, which resides in the bottom of the bottle. So one reason for decanting is to trap the sediment and thus keep it from getting into the wine glass. The original need to decant has dwindled over the last 50 years as technology in winemaking has improved, and among other things, modern filtration systems have been developed. Also, a few generations ago, more people actually liked to age their wine for decades before drinking them. But more recently, as the trend has been to younger, fruitier wines, decanting took on an entirely new reason. It rapidly blows air through tight young wines and helps to open up the flavor patterns. Paris's most exclusive restaurant, Taillevent, was one of the first to decant young wines for just this reason. Soon others followed. There are clear-thinking and reasonable restaurateurs here in Michigan who will decant because it's the logical thing to do, and would balk at the notion that an expensive wine deserves more attention. So there are many good reasons to decant a wine, but price is not one of them.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty.
Creation.
Vision.
The next idea.
What they have helped us do is to really think in a totally different way about how to deliver and create something new.
It's a long, long road from a great idea all the way to a company that's on its feet, providing jobs, pumping money into Michigan's economy. One of the biggest pitfalls is money. One hiccup in a fledgling company's funding could force that company to either fold before it ever gets going or to pick up and move to another state with more resources. Our latest contributor to The Next Idea is here to tell us about a big helping hand that Uncle Sam can give to entrepreneurs here in Michigan. Lisa Couric is managing partner of BBC Entrepreneurial Training and Consulting, known as BBC. Welcome, Lisa.
Thank you, Cynthia.
And Greg Gage is here. He's co-founder of Backyard Brains, based in Ann Arbor. Welcome, Greg.
Thank you for having me.
So, Greg, your company builds kits that, among other things, can make a cockroach leg dance.
Yeah.
Why?
That's a good question. I mean, I think it's self-explanatory, personally. I mean, why wouldn't you want to have a kit that allows cockroaches to be controlled or to control their legs? But if I have to tell you, I will say that we're actually a neuroscience company, a neuroscience education company. And so we use cockroaches as a way to sort of get access to the brain. And so I could put a wire into your head. I could drill a hole and put some wires in your head, and I could record from your brain activity. That's hard to do. I mean, it's you would probably not feel that
probably
well.
Object.
Yeah, you'd probably object. But with cockroaches, they have very, very similar neurons as we do. Neurons are the cells of the brain. And mm-hmm. so our company is based around the idea of sort of giving amateurs and sort of K-12 students access to tools that they typically wouldn't have access to until they decided to dedicate their life and become a PhD in neuroscience. So we sort of look at ourselves as kind of the equivalent of like a telescope manufacturer. So like, you don't have to get a PhD in astrophysics to understand a little bit about how the heavens work. You could go out and just buy a cheap telescope, set it up in your backyard, and you start becoming interested in science, maybe learning a little bit about how the stars and the planets move. In the biological sciences and in neuroscience in particular, there is no tools like that. So you have to sort of really go into a graduate program. So what we provide are these kind of really kind of DIY kind of entry level tools that do very, very, very advanced things.
So you had this great idea. How did it go from a great idea to a honest to God real company?
Yeah, so this is where I'm the co-founder of the company. So I'm an engineer by training, and I was working in a neuroscience lab, and my co-founder is a neuroscientist. We were going out to schools and just sort of showing how the brain works in the best ways we could. It was kind of all through analogy, but we were really missing out what we were doing. What we were doing in the lab was super cool. We were recording from real live neurons. You could hear them.
The wow factor.
It was really cool. I mean, I give lab tours. People loved it. So in 2008, Tim, who's my co-founder, and I decided, like, well, why don't we put together a self-imposed engineering challenge? And we're going to say, can we replicate our lab equipment under a budget of $100 so that we could sort of bring this into the classroom and sort of do what we're doing in the lab, sort of in the classroom. And so that's how the idea started. We just kind of did it for ourselves. We wrote an abstract for a scientific conference, and we said, you know, it was like in March. We said, hey, we're going to be doing this challenge. We're going to try to record spikes, which is what we call the unit of the how the brain communicates. It's called an action potential or a spike. We're going to try to record a spike for under $100. Come back in October, and you can see how we did. And so we did that, and we spent the entire summer kind of working on our prototypes and stuff like that, as entrepreneurs tend to do. We weren't entrepreneurs at the time. We were just kind of like grad students just trying to like impress our colleagues and friends and stuff like that.
Sure. So guys with a great idea.
Yeah, we had an idea.
And needed to grow.
And so then when we showed it off at the conference, we had an unexpected result, which was that people kept asking us they wanted to buy it. And we're like, oh, okay. Well, that wasn't really what we had in mind, but we kept getting these emails from people from all around the world saying they wanted to buy this. And it kind of dawned on us that this little side project should be the main project. And so we just then decided we're going to start forming a company. And so we created Backyard Brains. And at that time, we were just, you know, making the products in our living rooms and just soldering them together and then mailing them out around the world.
It's so a true tech story where you start with this idea and like you say, you're in your living room doing it.
Yeah.
And Lisa Keurig, BBC, is the kind of helping hand
exactly.
to take, right, we Lisa? Were, how did that work for these guys?
So what we do, Cynthia, is we run a program sponsored by the Michigan Economic Development Corporation to help entrepreneurs with great ideas that are based on technology figure out how to use non-dilutive federal funding, so these are grants and contracts from the federal government, to pay for the high-risk R&D that they have to do. So when Greg went to develop his idea with his partner, what happens is there's a huge gap between having the scientific or technical idea and then being able to reduce it to practice. And most sources of money to help grow a business don't want to come to the business until after that big technology risk is solved. So we call it the comeback when problem. Some business schools might call it the valley of death. So the federal government has a program called Small Business Innovation Research Grants and Contracts that help close that gap for really high-risk technologies that could have great impact in the market. But there's a learning curve on how to secure that type of money. And most scientists, inventors like Greg, know their technology and find business partners to know the business, but they have no idea how to approach the federal government for these types of grants. So we provide training and assistance sponsored by the state of Michigan to help Michigan-based entrepreneurs get this money. And it can be millions of dollars that can take them to the point where they can then find the resources to commercialize. And so that keeps our companies in Michigan. It lets them hire people. And these are great jobs because they're technical jobs. And because the technologies take a while to develop, that money can be the difference between them being successful and then, as you said at the introduction, either leaving the state where they can find other resources or just going out of business.
So these grants can help a Michigan tech entrepreneur cross that valley of death, as, yep, as you put in your essay, the loveless land of shrugs and empty pockets, and come back standing upright and staying right here in Michigan. Greg, how crucial.
Oh, my God. Yeah. had we have not gotten this grant, I don't think I'd be here talking to you today. This during that period, so you have the early adopters that will give you money. And so that helped us out in the beginning. Yeah. But there's this period, which is this valley that of death. I never heard of that, but that's exactly what it is, where there's still a little bit of money coming in, but you're still waiting from the early adopters to people starting to understand and actually want that product. And so that's where the SBIR fund, the Small Business Innovative Research Funding, does well. And so I don't know, if it wasn't for the BBC, I mean, there's no way. I mean, I've written grants before at the university, but those grants, you write just the science portion. That's hard to do. I mean, it's really hard to write a successful grant. But beyond that, there's like when you submit to the federal government, there are about 70 other pages of stuff that you would never know even what the,
it's a different beast altogether.
Yeah, even the language is strange. And so that's where the BBC comes in. We had our first meeting. I think they probably thought we were crazy at first. but they kind of sat us down and kind of walked us through the process of what, and she said, the first thing is like, all right, you guys focus on the science first. And so we were doing that. And then they kind of like walked us through the rest of the process. And so
they held your hand.
They did. And it was perfect. And even the way the grants are structured was helpful for us, because we got phase one, which is the first pot of money. That was for 2 years. And then we used the BBC again very heavily for phase two, which is the competitive renewal of that grant. And that's where the money is almost three times bigger than it was for the first one. It's for 3 years as well.
And that's so smart, right, Lisa? It isn't just they get this big pot of money when they're not at a point to know what to do with that money.
That's right. And the federal program is structured in a way, and the way we work with them is structured in a way that they get it in, to use investment language, tranches. But what we've found in this program and why it's been so exceptional that we've had longevity in the state with this program is that we work on hundreds a year with our clients. They work on one or two a year maybe. And so as Greg was off working on his technology development, when it was time to go back for the other grant, we were still there to help him get the bigger pot of money and to help him keep going in securing this money. So we're not the grant writers. Greg was and his team were the grant writers, but we help them. We help you understand how to use this form of money as part of your company's funding strategy. And because it's such a different piece of it, we give you all the hands-on training and assistance that you need to put in really well-crafted proposals.
Lisa, how aware are other entrepreneurs in Michigan about these grants and also about the kind of help that you can give them of the work you do at BBC?
Great question, Cynthia. We have a network of partners that we work with across the state, including the Smart Zones, the technology transfer offices at the universities, the local and regional economic development organizations. But, you know, we find that as many people know about us, there's always changeover. And we're six people strong at BBC, but we always need help in getting the word out.
Greg, what's next for Backyard Brains? What's your next goal?
Oh, man, we've got so currently we are working on many projects. Our next phase is we're going to launch into the International Space Station. So we're having a relationship that we've been slowly building with NASA, but as you can imagine, there's a lot of hurdles you have to get through. But we've been working. We've actually moved up from cockroaches. We're now in – we actually do human electrophysiology now, so we can record EEG signals from the brain and from the muscles as well. And so we're working with NASA to understand muscle fatigue in space. And so the goal, if it continues on, is we're going to have live experiments being done simultaneously both in space and then in the classroom, so that you can see like why do astronauts do certain type of exercises and not other ones? So we can actually measure that directly by looking at the electrical activity inside the body and what forces build up and when they don't. So turns out in space you can't lift up weights. So it doesn't make any difference. Mm. You need bending and sort of like Bowflex type things. And so that's our next big one. But we want to expand. Right now we've expanded into South America. So our products they're kind of low-priced versions of kind of high-priced medical equipment. And so right now we're using it for education, but in Latin America we're actually using it for core research. Neuroscientists and researchers are using our gear to publish, you know, scientific literature.
And yet you're staying right here in Michigan.
We're staying here in Michigan, yeah. So we're we have we have 13 employees now. When we started, when we were writing this grant, we had one employee. So Tim and I were half-time. Mm. So, we're continuing to grow here. And so that's it.
And that's, by the way, one of the great things for the state is, you know, this went from two guys half-time and this state-funded program, which is us, helping them. And now there are 13 great jobs in Michigan. So that's a wonderful success story, and they'll keep growing.
Lisa, how many Michigan entrepreneurs or companies apply for these grants each year with your help?
You know, it's hundreds, Cynthia. I don't know the exact number, but it's hundreds. But there's many more that do that haven't found us yet, and that, you know, and there are some that think they can do it on their own. So we're always trying to get more of them engaged so that they can become more successful.
Are we above average in the country here in Michigan?
We are above average in the country. The companies that come through our program, which isn't all of them, have about twice the success rate as the national average.
Well, a good place to get started if you're an entrepreneur is by going to BBC's website, which is bbcetc.com. And Greg Gage of BYB, Backyard Brains. Exciting, cool work, and best of luck to you.
Thank you.
And, of course, Lisa's essay is on the next idea page at michiganradio.org. We welcome your thoughts there, or at Michigan Radio's Facebook page, or on Twitter at NextIdeaMI. Lisa Couric, Greg Gage, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks very much, Cynthia.
Support for the Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
The Hell's Half Mile Film and Music Festival begins today in Bay City. Alan LaFave is founder and director of the festival. Great name, Alan, Hell's Half Mile. Tell us about its history.
Well, as much as I love my hometown of Bay City, Michigan, the name Bay City just doesn't have a lot of sexiness to it. So we looked for something that was truly Bay City, part of our history, but then also had a little bit of a ring to it. And Hell's Half Mile comes from a bit of our history from the mid to late 1800s when we were a lumber town. And in the spring, the lumbermen would come back to the city with their paychecks, and they would go down to a half-mile stretch on the waterfront in downtown Bay City that the locals called Hell's Half Mile, because that's where all the saloons and brothels and things were located. Lots of fights and things like that would happen as well. So it's had a colorful history and a little bit of irreverence to it, and we decided that was us.
Now, what gave you the idea to up and start your own film festival and then turn it, broaden it into a music festival?
Well, we're a couple hours away from Detroit, so we have to drive down there a lot, down to Detroit and Ann Arbor, to see a lot of really great bands. So I was down at the Blind Pig with some friends one weekend, and we talked about, geez, it would be great if we could bring the bands we love up to Bay City. And then following that summer, we were up in Traverse City for the first annual Traverse City Film Festival. And we thought to ourselves that we really need to do this. We need to combine our passions of film and music and bring them to Bay City. And we decided that's what we were going to do.
And here you are 10 years later. What kind of films do you screen?
They're all independent films, narrative features, documentaries, shorts, animated foreign language films, student shorts, everything from anywhere. So we're not just showing films from Michigan or the Midwest or the U.S. It's films from all around the world.
And what about the music?
The music, that changes every year as well. We have bands mostly from the Midwest, but we also this year have bands, a band from Brooklyn, New York. We have bands from Grand Rapids and Detroit and a couple from Bay City as well. But that changes, and that's all indie music, and that's one of our focuses is to stay with the independent world.
And it's also something you want to use to bring people into the arts, participating, not just watching.
Yeah, and that was something that came around from when I was participating in the old Cool Cities Committee for Bay City way back when under Jennifer Granholm's governorship. One of the things that we discovered when we were talking to people about what makes a cool city is Well, it's all these varied levels of interest. You know, we have a lot of different things going on that makes a city very, very cool. So we decided to start our own, follow our own passion, and hopefully that'll inspire people to follow theirs and to create something that makes our city that much more interesting.
And you've got jury awards, an audience choice award. You also have some other things planned. There's a half-mile race. Is that a Long Hills half mile?
Yeah, it actually is. It's the first year we're doing it. It's the Hells Half Mile Half Mile. So we are running a half mile. It's a great little event. All the participants get their 0.5-mile sticker and and all those great things. And it's just a fun little thing that we wanted to add this year.
And a crowdfunding competition to do what?
Yeah, crowdfunding rally. It's our way of sort of giving back to filmmakers. We wanted to find a way to convert our audience and festival goers into contributors for the filmmakers that we love, and the filmmakers from the Midwest as well. So we've partnered with a company called Seed and Spark, and they're a crowdfunding platform. And we're doing an online portion first, and then we're doing a live pitch at the festival. And the audience chooses the pitch they love the most, and the prize package goes to that film. And the great thing is that every other film that participates, every other project, has the opportunity to pick up audience and contributions from people if they just sell them on what their project is.
Very, very interesting, and it sounds like a lot of fun. The Hell's Half Mile Film and Music Festival happening September 24th to the 27th in Bay City, and you can get all the details at the website hhmfest.com. Alan LaFave is the festival founder and the director. Thank you so much for sharing this with us, Alan.
Thank you.
Today's Stateside was directed by Ellie Billings. Our executive producer is Zoe Clark. Today's engineer was Bob Scon. Contributors are Mercedes Mejia, Mike Blank, Emily Fox, and Ryan Grimes. Joe Lindstroth is producer of The Next Idea. Stateside's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.
Support for The Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.